This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As we approach the fifth anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Natasha Trethewey has been thinking of the hurricane's aftermath on the Mississippi Gulf Coast, where she spent much of her childhood and where her part of her family still lives. And she's been thinking of the hurricane's aftermath on her family. Her brother spent a year in prison. Her grandmother sheltered from the storm in a public school and was never able to return home. Her house was unlivable after Katrina, and she was too frail, disoriented, and undernourished after the storm to continue living alone. Natasha Trethewey moved her grandmother to a nursing home near her when she was teaching at Duke University, and then to Atlanta, where Trethewey is a professor at Emory University. Trethewey won the Pulitzer Prize for her book Native Guard. Many of the poems were about growing up biracial in Mississippi and Georgia. Her mother was African American, her father is white. When they divorced, Trethewey lived with her mother and eventually a stepfather and her younger brother Joe. After her mother and stepfather divorced, her stepfather murdered her mother. Trethewey's new book is called Beyond Katrina, A Meditation on the Mississippi Gulf Coast. Natasha Trethewey, welcome back to Fresh Air. After your grandmother died in her 90s, you brought her back to her hometown, Gulfport, Mississippi, and had her buried at her church. How long after Katrina was this?
This was in 2008, 3 years after Katrina.
What state was the church in?
The church was still in the process of rebuilding. They weren't using the sanctuary at the time, and so her service had to take place in a small auxiliary building where they often serve food, a very low-ceilinged room that was filled up with whatever they were able to salvage from the main sanctuary. So a few pews, some folding chairs. I think they even had a kind of small pulpit to use for the minister. But the windows all around the sanctuary, the high windows, were still blown out and some boarded up. And so if you were to have driven by it, you would not have thought that any services were ever taking place in this building.
How did it feel to bring your grandmother back to a place that was still in such a place of such a state of chaos and disrepair?
It made me feel like Katrina wasn't over. That for the people there and the people connected to those people, it was still going on. That recovery was taking such a long time. And there was something sort of sad and homely about having to have her final homegoing service in that little room rather than in the beautiful sanctuary for which she had sewn the draperies of the baptismal font, the same place that my mother was memorialized.
And to bring her body to a place that had been partially destroyed, you know, it's death and destruction in one ceremony.
Mm-hmm. And even the stranger feeling of not getting to get her back there even whole. I know it sounds odd, but my grandmother had an amputation right before her death. And so she went back without her leg.
Did she have diabetes?
She didn't. That, which is the strange thing. She didn't have diabetes at all. She just got, she had really poor circulation, perhaps from having sat as a drapery seamstress all that time. And she got a wound on her ankle that wouldn't heal. Hmm. Which is kind of like what it feels like on the coast right now.
So when you brought your grandmother back to Gulfport, Mississippi, her hometown, where you had lived as well, it just seems like the intersection of so many things that had gone wrong in your family's life since the storm. Mm-hmm. You know, your grandmother had to die away from her home. The church that she was buried in her hometown was still partially destroyed. And your brother had recently been imprisoned, and he was allowed out to come view his grandmother, but yes. That was it. He wasn't really allowed to speak with you or your husband or his child or his girlfriend. So I'd like to talk a little bit about what happened to your brother and how Katrina changed his life. In the year leading up to Katrina, he'd started to repair rental properties that your great uncle used to own. What were these properties?
There were several little lots that held shotgun houses, really small shacks that were so tiny that often the bathtub was in the kitchen. But they were the kinds of homes that low-income people on the coast could afford. They rented right up until the storm for about $230 to $250 a month. And we'd had tenants there who'd been there for perhaps 30 years.
And then your brother ended up working on them, repairing them. What was his relationship to these homes?
Well, in the months leading up to the storm, my brother finally began to take over this family business. We'd been hoping for years that he would. My grandmother was getting too old to be able to handle the business of managing these properties and hiring out people to do repairs and collecting rent. So my brother began to do this. And when he started doing it, he began to really fix them up. Fix the roof and add new appliances and carpet and windows. So he was doing that kind of work, and the tenants were really happy that he was fixing up these places that had fallen into disrepair over the last few years. So this is what he was doing right up until the hurricane, and he invested a great deal of his savings into being able to fix them up.
And he was in the position of soon being able to see some profits from that.
That's right. He had all but one of them, I think, rented.
So what happened after Katrina? Were the homes destroyed?
They were damaged so badly that the tenants couldn't stay in them. The buildings were really sort of falling down around them. And so they had to leave. And the buildings at that point were torn down by the city because they were blighted. And if you can't afford it at the moment to fix them up, then the city will just tear them down and bill you for it.
How much do they bill you for tearing down a house?
A few thousand dollars.
So instead of making you money, now your brother was really in debt because
he
was billed for all the homes that had to be torn down as a result of Katrina.
That's right. And then, of course, having to pay the taxes then on the vacant land just to try to hold on at least to the land.
Okay, so tell us the story of how he was imprisoned.
Well, I think that it was in a moment of profound despair that my brother, when contacted by someone he'd known a long time and asked to deliver a large amount of cocaine, agreed. He did it. He told me, about $4,000. And so when the person asked him to do it, he did it again. He must have done it a couple of times before someone set him up. I think someone who was perhaps trying to make a deal for himself told the police about Joe, and they were waiting for him.
Yeah.
And he was caught with 4 ounces of cocaine on him.
And when was this?
Well, it happened in the spring of 2007, though he didn't tell me about it then. He didn't tell me about it because that was the moment that happy things were going on in my life, and he didn't want to ruin that.
By happy things, I'm guessing you mean that's when you won the Pulitzer Prize for poetry.
That's right. So at the same time that I was winning the prize, he was being arrested.
So how did you find out?
He didn't tell me until a year later when he was about to go to trial, and his lawyer told him that if he didn't call me and ask me to come down there and to speak on his behalf, that he might be in jail a very long time.
Did you speak at his trial?
I did.
What did you say?
Well, I tried to explain to the judge something about his history. One of the main things I wanted her to know was how good a kid he is, but how tragic his life had been and how different his life was from mine. I was older when we lost our mother, and I still had my own father, but it was his father, my stepfather, who killed our mother. So at once he lost both of his parents, and he was an 11-year-old boy when it happened. And the morning that our mother was killed, my brothers had to live with this, but he was waiting at the bus stop, and his father came and got him and took his key and let himself into our apartment. And my brother recalls the last thing my mother said to him, which was, "Why did you let him in?" And Joe tried to tell her that wasn't the case. But because of that, I think he's carried that burden of guilt. And then when he went to live with my grandmother, a woman who loved him dearly but could not look at him without seeing the face of the man who killed her daughter. And so it made their relationship very strained. But that's the house he had to grow up in. Yeah, when he lost his parents.
We talked about this on a previous visit to Fresh Air because you'd written a book of poems about your mother's murder. And your stepfather had abused your mother. And then I think it was right after you got out of high school that he murdered her. He shot her twice in the head and in the neck.
Yes.
And so I guess...
My brother was there to see that.
He actually witnessed it.
Yes.
And then felt guilty because your stepfather had taken your brother's key to get into the house because your stepfather tried to kill your mother once before, so she didn't want him anywhere near her. They were divorced.
That's right.
It's so interesting to think about how your family history and your brother's family history compare. I mean, your parents, when you were born, it was an interracial marriage. Your mother, African-American, your father, white. Your father is a poet and professor. Your mother at the time was a social worker.
Yes.
And I don't know what your stepfather did for a living.
He was a Vietnam veteran, and he went to technical college and so had a business as a repairman, air conditioning and cooling systems. And he also worked as a maintenance man for a facility for kids who were in trouble.
Oh. So, you know, your brother grew up in a home where his mother was abused. By the time she was abused, you were a little older, and you'd already had some stability in your life. I guess he really never knew what that kind of stability was like and what a safe home was like.
Well, actually, the funny thing about it is, and he tries to address some of this in the letters that he wrote to me, up until the moment that my mother had to run away with him to get out of the house, he thought he had a perfect life. He thought he had two parents who loved him and, you know, a house in the suburbs, and he didn't want for anything. He'd only had a glimpse of the way that his father could be angry or volatile, just a very small glimpse. And he didn't really know that the abuse was taking place.
Did you?
I did. You know, being older, I guess I was more aware, and I could see what was going on, and I'd wake up in the middle of the night when he would stay asleep and hear what was going on.
And you protected your brother from that knowledge?
Yes.
How much older are you?
I'm 7 years older.
That's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
When your brother was in prison, he wrote a poem. Would you reprint in the book? And I'd like you to read that poem.
I'd be happy to. The poem is called Cycle. I am named after my father. He's named after his. No disrespect to my grandfather resting. I pronounce my name Joel instead of Joel. I am nothing like him. Although I am in prison, I'm not him.
I like that poem when I like that, you know, I am not him. And I think I think he must have been surprised that he wrote a poem. I was surprised. I don't know him. But, I mean, you're the professional poet. Were right. you surprised that he wrote a poem in prison?
I was very surprised. He actually wrote a couple. That's the only one that I print in the book. But he was writing letters and meditations and poems when he was in prison. That one was particularly moving to me because it had never occurred to me when I was thinking about my own grief and the burden of this history that we share, that he was carrying the added burden of being named the same name as the man who murdered our mother.
You wrote a poem about your brother leaving prison. It's called Benediction. I'd like you to read that for us.
Yes, I'd be happy to. Benediction. I thought that when I saw my brother walking through the gates of the prison, he would look like a man entering his life. And he did. He carried a small bag, holding it away from his body as if he would not touch it, or that it weighed almost nothing. The clothes he wore seemed to belong to someone else, like hand-me-downs given a child who will one day grow into them. Behind him at the fence, the inmates were waving, someone saying, "All right now." And then my brother was walking toward us, a few awkward steps at first until he got it. How to hold up the two big pants with one hand and in the other carry everything else he had.
Was there anything that helped your brother get through his time in prison?
Well, the thing that really helped him get through was that he had a kind of faith in justice. I mean, my brother is not a religious person really either, but he could have faith in human beings to do the just thing. He also told me that he got through by writing, knowing that he was contributing to this project, that his words would matter.
To what project?
And his story.
Your book?
That's right.
Is that why he wrote?
I told him that I was working on the book and that I needed to know as much about his experience as I could. And so he started writing some things that he thought would be useful for me. But then, because he was doing that, he started writing these other things as well, like poetry, that he did not think would have anything to do with what I was writing. And he didn't know that, nor did I at the time, that I would use anything directly written by him. So once he got into the habit of trying to write things to me about his past or what he remembered of our family from when he was growing up, he also, on the other hand, started writing poems and doing things for himself that helped to get him through. And, of course, they became things that I do use in the book.
So it's nice that this book was kind of a collaborative project with your brother, even though you were physically separated.
That's right.
Is he still writing?
He is still writing. He was given a lovely journal from a good friend of mine as a get out of prison gift. And so since then, he's been writing his thoughts in it, and I'm trying to encourage him to, you know, maybe let some of us see what he's writing, but right. He hasn't done that yet.
Okay. What is he doing now?
He is looking for work, seeing his parole officer, taking classes at the community college toward his GED. It's been hard for him to find work. You know, he's got to check the box that says he was a convicted felon.
During the first year that you were a Pulitzer Prize winner and you were getting, you know, more attention than you were used to, once you found out about your brother's incarceration, did you try to, like, keep that quiet when being interviewed? Did you try not to call attention to it?
Well, I did. I worried very much about whether or not people would judge my brother for that. And even when I started writing this book, or writing at least the finishing it, the second half, when everything changed, when I found out that he was going to prison, I had a hard time writing it because I felt that I needed to explain to someone, to this imaginary reader, the entire story from the moment he was born so that people would empathize with him. And so that really kept me from being able to write for a long time. I don't worry about that as much now. I think that there are so many people who have difficult stories like this in families, and that people are not simply waiting to sit in judgment, but instead are open to trying to understand how people feel despair and push to make difficult decisions that may not be the best ones.
So what convinced you to tell his story in your book?
Well, it took so long for me to be able to see that telling his story would be useful not only to give voice to his own experience, but actually as a way of allowing his story to speak for the countless people whose stories aren't being told. My fear was that he would be judged and that people would simply think, well, you know, this is a drug dealer. This is just who this guy is. And I said this to my agent. I said this to my editor. And finally, one of them said to me, you're trying to convince people who can't be convinced. I mean, the people who are going to think he's just a drug dealer mm-hmm. aren't going to be changed by anything you have to say, nor are they going to read the book. That's what they told me. And once I felt a little freer that I didn't have to explain over and over again what a good guy he is and that if he hadn't had this happen and this happen and this happen, he never would have done this. But it was really difficult. And I even think he worried about it. And I think he's so happy and so relieved now that it's not a secret, that the story is out, that people already know before they ever meet him, so that he doesn't have to try to, you know, skirt around any details of his life or when people ask him, what do you do, or, you know, that kind of thing.
If you're just joining us, my guest is the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Natasha Trethewey, and her new book is called Beyond Katrina, A Meditation on the Mississippi Gulf Coast. I'm just thinking that at the same time you won the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry in 2007, your brother was arrested for carrying cocaine, carrying it for somebody else, but carrying it. And it's the kind of thing, like, it's so parallel that you wouldn't write that in a story because it would seem contrived.
Right.
I just wonder what you make of the simultaneity simultaneity or near simultaneity of that, and what it has to say about your life.
Well, oddly enough, before I knew about that, I kept thinking about another bit of simultaneity, and that was that 10 days shy of my mother's 41st birthday, she was murdered. And 10 days shy of my 41st birthday, I won the Pulitzer. So I was very mindful of that strange coincidence that, you know, at this point in both of our lives, this is what we'd come to. So a year later, when I found out that my brother had gotten arrested, it was in many ways another ripple or echo of this family story. I mean, you know, people think of prison as social death. So whereas my mother was literally dead, my brother was about to enter into a kind of social death at the exact moment that I was having a resurrection of sorts. And I am the kind of person that's always sort of putting these things together and attaching meaning and extracting things from them. So this was so huge in my mind because, you know, my name is Natasha, which means, you know, it's the diminutive in Russian of Natalia, which means Christmas child, but it's also the diminutive of Anastasia from the Greek, which means resurrection. And so there I was sort of seeing myself as the resurrection child. And, you know, my mother and my brother, quite the opposite of that. You're right when you say it's as if, you know, if you were to write it, it would seem too contrived. And yet, indeed, it seems to have been a pattern already in my life.
So does it make you guilty that you got the Pulitzer at exactly the time in your life that your mother was murdered, and you got the Pulitzer at the same time your brother was arrested? Do you feel like it's just unfair that, like, I'm not even sure?
Yeah. I think I do feel a good measure of guilt. I've carried with me a lot of survivor's guilt, I think. And the coincidence of what happened to me before my 41st birthday and my mother's 41st birthday really highlights that for me. And with my brother, I think I definitely feel that. It seems so unfair to me that you could come from the same household and yet have such dramatically different lives.
But you didn't quite come from the same household.
No, it's true. We didn't. I know. That's right. I guess I feel guilty that I couldn't protect him from it. When she died, you know, because I was 7 years older than him, my brother began to look to me as a kind of a surrogate mother. I was the one that he clung to in that way. And yet, I couldn't mother him or protect him in the way I wish I could have. And when he was in prison, I think that was really so difficult. And yet, you know, I'm always looking back at the failures. And for me, one of my failures during that time was the kind of responses that I gave to him. I mean, my brother was writing to me. He would call, and, you know, I would never miss a phone call. I'd do everything I could to be there for a phone call. If he needed anything, I would send it. You know, I along with his girlfriend Aisha, I worked tirelessly calling and emailing the commissioner of prisons in the state of Mississippi and other people in the office, you know, to get my brother released and to have him moved to the facility we wanted him to be in so that he could be close to family. All that kind of legwork, you know, I was willing to do. But what I never once did was write him a letter.
That seems so odd. I mean, you're a writer. He started writing when he was in prison. Why didn't you write him?
Terry, I do not know. And once it hit me, it felt like the worst betrayal ever. And one of the first things I did when he was out was to sit him down and apologize for it. And he, you know, not once when he was there did he, you know, ask me to. And I know now that it probably hurt him deeply. And I don't know why it didn't occur to me. It didn't occur to me at all.
You grew up fearing hurricanes. You were three when Hurricane Camille hit the Gulf Coast, and that was a very destructive hurricane, though not as destructive as Katrina. What are your memories as a three-year-old of Camille?
What I remember, and I think I remember this, you know, sometimes we have memories that are given to us because the stories have been told so often in families, but it seems so vivid to me, the storm hitting us and rain pouring in through the roof and my mother and father and grandmother and uncle running from room to room trying to catch as much water as possible with pots. The hurricane lamps lit. My mother and grandmother sort of terrified and praying out loud as they ran through the hallways. And then I remember just sort of seeing the house the next day and the destruction at the church that was across the street.
You know, you describe in your book what it was like as a child every year to see, to turn on the TV and see a footage of Hurricane Camille and how frightening it was to you. And it made me think about all the children growing up now in the Gulf who, for the last 5 years, you know, first they witnessed Katrina and then every year they watch it again on television. Mm-hmm. And how disturbing that must be to relive it every year.
Yeah, you know, it's as if what is supposed to keep you safe is this imagery that you have to look at again and again. And what I've been wondering is if the children of Katrina will respond differently to the threat of natural disaster than those of us who were the children of Camille. I mean, so many people who managed to ride out Camille and with their homes for the most part intact had a kind of fearlessness when Katrina was bearing down. You know, my grandmother was one of them, thinking that Camille was the worst thing that could have happened to us. So why be afraid of this hurricane that's coming? And yet it was worse.
You know, in your book, Beyond Katrina, you write that, you know, your grandmother was a God-fearing woman. And when Hurricane Camille destroyed the church across the street, but only partially destroyed your grandmother's home, she took that as a message. What was the message from God that she interpreted?
Well, she felt that she had been spared, and having been spared had a greater call to duty. And so began to do as much as she could for the church. For example, making the draperies, these huge red velvet draperies for the baptismal font. She also allowed the church to park its bus in her driveway. The church didn't have its own driveway. She became even more devoted because she thought she had been spared.
Is that the church she was buried in?
Yes.
Do you, you describe yourself as not a religious person, but do you ever wish that you could have religion like your grandmother did and therefore find some kind of holy meaning in the most horrible things that have happened?
I think, you know, she had such a faith, and it I understood it as a great comfort to her. And there are times that I think, that I wish I had such a comfort. I remember when she was being remembered at her service, the preacher looking directly at me and saying, "Grieve not as others grieve." He was sermonizing about how the faithful don't have the same kind of grief because they know that there is something else. And so I felt indicted as he looked at me and said, "Grieve not as others grieve," as if he was pointing to me and saying, "I know that you are not the faithful, and because of that, you have a different kind of grief. The wrong kind."
And were you changed by that at all?
Oh, I was angry.
Angry at him for making you feel that way when you were grieving.
Yes,
I think, as if there were a wrong kind of grief.
I think I wanted remembrance of her, and I wanted comfort. I mean, I think funeral services are for the living in some ways. They're to remember the dead, but in the face of the living beloved. And so I didn't feel comforted.
Not to make things too pat, but I think by writing poetry, you're kind of extracting meaning from things.
Oh, I think so. I mean, there's a poem in which I even talk about something that's a kind of faith. I think poetry is always a kind of faith. It is the kind that I have. It is what can offer solace, meaning, but also make sense of even this liturgical language in a secular way that allows me to understand these events.
Natasha Trethewey, I really wish the best to you and to your brother. And thank you very much for speaking to us and for reading some of your poetry.
Thank you, Terry. It's good to talk to you.
Natasha Trethewey's new book of prose and poetry is called Beyond Katrina, A Meditation on the Mississippi Gulf Coast. You can hear her read another poem, and you can read an excerpt of her book on our website, freshair.npr.org. Like Sherlock Holmes, Miss Marple, and Sam Spade, Charlie Chan is one of the immortal detectives in fiction. But unlike those other investigators, Chan, especially in recent decades, is a figure who stirred up discomfort, even anger, among audiences. A new book about Charlie Chan explores the tangled history and meaning of the Chinese super sleuth. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Depending on your cultural politics, you'll find the following film clip either charming or wince-making. It's a scene from the 1934 film Charlie Chan in London. Our venerable detective is being congratulated by a British official for his cleverness in discovering the true identity of a dastardly criminal.
The British government, Mr. Chan, is therefore very deeply indebted to you.
Much honored to be of humble service to British Lion.
It's remarkable, Mr. Chan, how you ever suspected Barstow. He puts up an excellent front.
Front seldom tell truth. To know occupants of house, always look in backyard.
Provided there is one.
Excuse. Every front has back. And little things tell big story.
The actor who played Charlie Chan in that and 40 other films was Warner Oland. Like Sidney Toler, the actor who succeeded him in the role, Oland was Caucasian, Swedish, in fact. But to Hollywood, Oland looked vaguely Asiatic. To play Chan, Oland merely brushed his eyebrows up and had a few drinks to make his speech more halting and to put a grin on his face, like the perpetually congenial Chinese sleuth. Offensive, right? But before we condemn Oland's yellow face incarnation of Charlie Chan, consider this next curious bit of film history. In 1933, Oland made a trip to Shanghai, where he was celebrated by movie audiences there for bringing to life the first positive Chinese character in American film. After all, compared to the venal Dr. Fu Manchu, whom Oland had also played in the movies, Chan was a hero. The nascent Chinese film industry then got busy making a series of homegrown Charlie Chan movies. According to contemporary accounts, the Chinese actor who played Chan scrupulously copied the white Oland's screen Chinese mannerisms and speech. Cultural cross-pollination at work, at its most endearing or dismaying. That film anecdote appears in Yunta Huang's fascinating and sometimes maddening new work of cultural history called simply Charlie Chan. Huang was born in China and is now a professor of English here. This is his first book intended to appeal to a popular audience. It reads as though it were composed by Charlie Chan's number one son, frenetically dashing off in 100 directions all at once, some illuminating, some just plain G-pop loony, setting out to investigate the vexed meaning and legacy of the figure of Charlie Chan. Huang also explores, among other subjects, the history of Chinese immigration to America, the career of Clarence Darrow, sandalwood and sugarcane production in the Hawaiian Islands, the history of aphorisms in English, beginning with Ben Franklin, and finally, his own immigration saga, from student in Beijing to owner of a Chinese takeout joint in Alabama to academic. But Charlie Chan is such a marvelous and controversial figure that the subject alone more than makes up for any infelicities in Huang's style. One of the real finds this book presents is the tale of Chan's real-life counterpart, Chang Apana, the heretofore forgotten Chinese-American detective who was the inspiration for the 6 Charlie Chan novels that first began appearing in 1925, written by yet another white guy, Earl Derbiggers. Apana joined the Honolulu police force in 1898. Standing all of a wiry 5 feet tall, Apana arrested gamblers, opium addicts, and escaped lepers using a leather bullwhip that he made himself. As Huang chronicles, though, Apana's famous bullwhip was useless against the anti-Asian racism that prevailed within the police force and society of his time. The suspicion that Charlie Chan himself is nothing but a racist stereotype has led many contemporary Asian American critics to dismiss him as a yellow Uncle Tom and help precipitate the great Chan ban of the old movies from TV network schedules. Huang, however, loves Charlie Chan and sees in him something more empowering, a Chinese incarnation of the American trickster or con artist figure. Huang says, "He reminds me of Monkey King. In Chinese folk myth, Monkey King is an invisible trickster who hides his weapon in his ear. Charlie Chan is that Monkey King, concealing his aphoristic barbs inside his tummy." Huang's mishmash book, with its profusion of Chan material, will certainly complicate, not quell, the debate over Chan's legacy. But as the great detective himself said, mind, like parachute, only function when open.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Charlie Chan, The Untold Story of the Honorable Detective and His Rendezvous with American History by Yunta Huang. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show.